I'm Bex, and welcome to the Week Junior Show. Today, I'm joined by three of the team from the Week Junior. That's the magazine Making Sense of the World for 8 to 14-year-olds. We've got Kieran.
Hello.
Flora.
Hello.
And Hugh.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Hugh. A new person has entered the podcast arena. Now, the new issue of the Week Junior magazine is packed with everything you need to know about the most important and fascinating things happening around the planet and beyond. So inside, you'll find an explanation of the conflict between Israel and Palestine, a version of Instagram being designed for under 13s, a peek inside the Story Museum in the English city of Oxford, plus much, much more. If you want to get your hands on a copy of The Week Junior, you can get a 6-week free trial by going to dennismags.co.uk/theweekjunior and use the code podcast. So, on to business. On this week's show, we'll be talking about China landing a rover on Mars, a nationwide beach clean, and some big football finals. Plus, we'll have a debate all about ancient monuments. But before all of that, given that we'll be talking about beaches, I want to know, what is everybody's favourite beach anywhere in the world? Kieran, you can go first.
This was quite difficult to decide because you have to compare very different beaches, don't you, in order to find the top beach of all time. So I have controversially, I think, gone for Brighton Beach because it is absolutely lovely, although it is a pebble beach, which would normally have points going against it. But it's got a lot of great chippies around and a very nice pier, so I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt on this one.
So you've gone for food over sitting ability.
Correct, that is exactly what I've gone for, as always.
Good to know. Flora, how about you?
Well, I would say I agree with you, Kieran, that there are loads of different categories and they're all very subjective. Like, I think Pebble Beach is an absolute win. Otherwise, you're getting sand, you know, down your pants everywhere. It's just too annoying.
Wow.
But my favourite beach is actually a sandy beach, also controversially. And it's Frinton Beach in Essex, where my family have a beach hut on stilts above the sea. And we've been going there my whole life. It's always completely empty because it's not the most scenic or beautiful place in the world. In fact, it's pretty ugly. It's a huge wind farm just off the coast. The sand is it's not even like sand, it's like concrete, like yellow concrete. Flat and compacted. There are all these concrete bomb shelters from World War II all around the field, just behind the hut, and this huge golf course. The fish and chips are pretty disgusting, but the hut is just the most beautiful place in the whole world. It's just so peaceful. And I love going there and watching the wind turbines spin very slowly and just sort of reading and thinking and talking. I've even slept there a few times, and I've definitely had the happiest memories of my whole life there.
Crikey, Flora, if that's your favourite, I'd love to know what your least favourite is. Oh, my days. All right, well, I mean, no offence, Flora, I don't think I'll be visiting Frinton Beach very, very soon. Hugh, tell me, what's your favourite?
Okay, mine is a little bit controversial as well, in the sense that I've not actually been there yet, but I am going next month. I'm doing the Hebridean Way, which is a 185-mile cycle over 10 islands from Battersea in the south of the Outer Hebrides up into the Butt of Lewis and the Outer Hebrides. So I'm choosing Luskintyre Beach, which is on Harris, miles of white sand, turquoise sea. You can see sea eagles. There are also wild horses there. They're called the Pale Ponies of Luskintyre, and they just wander around the place munching in the macaire. So I'm looking forward to seeing them.
Well, I have gone, I think we've all gone for, yeah, British-based beaches, which is interesting. I have gone for Bamborough because I am near the northeast right now. And Bamborough Beach is sandy, which is a tick for me. It has a beautiful castle nearby. The only thing is it can be quite windy, so it's quite bracing if you were to walk upon it. I wouldn't say it's a sunbathing beach. Anyway, I also want to know what everybody's favourite fact is from this week. Kieran, what have you learnt?
Well, talking of beaches, and of course you have an ice lolly when you go to the beach, a 12-year-old boy in the US has achieved the Guinness World Record for the world's tallest structure made out of wooden ice lolly sticks. His creation is incredible. Measured 6.157 metres, very specific, and that's taller than two male Asian elephants plonked one on top of the other. So, remarkable.
Flora, what have you learnt?
I learnt that white-tailed eagles are the largest bird of prey in the UK, and they were hunted to extinction around 100 years ago. And they've been reintroduced in Scotland and the Isle of Wight, and now they're being reintroduced to Norfolk as well.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, great fact. And Hugh, what have you learned?
I've learned that the Titan arum is the largest flowering structure without branches on Earth. It can grow up to 3 metres tall, which is twice the height of an average wee junior reader, probably. But it only produces flowers every 7 to 9 years, sometimes even 10. And that's just as well because it is also the smelliest plant on Earth. It's known as the corpse flower. And so when it flowers, it only blooms for 48 hours and it smells of rotting flesh. So while some pollinators like bees and butterflies are attracted to, you know, the colours and aromas of lovely scented flowers, the Titan arum attracts the pollinators that love to feed and breed on rotting flesh and poo.
Oh my goodness. So if you were there, you'd want to take a picture, but you'd also want a peg on your nose. Is that
absolutely
right?
Stinks. Yes, that's the one.
All right. Well, I might give that a miss. Now, Kieran, tell me, I believe you have a big real or rubbish story for me today. What are you trying to trick me with?
I would never try to trick you with anything, Bex. But given that it's real or rubbish, I wanted to start with a couple of questions. Do you know where France is?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How about Belgium?
Yeah, I've been there.
Okay, so we are doing better than one Belgian farmer who stars in this week's Real or Rubbish story. The farmer in question was getting annoyed that a boulder in his field was getting in the way of his tractor. So he decided to move it. Only, here is the thing, that very boulder sets out the border between France and Belgium. It was placed there in 1819, and by moving the stone around 2 metres south, the farmer had made Belgium that little bit bigger and France that little bit smaller. So, is this rolling news story, get it, yeah, Neil? Or have we told a borderline lie? There you go, 2-1.
So you're telling me the border of France and Belgium is in control by a farmer who's just randomly rolling it around?
Yes, I mean, I would imagine that border officials aren't particularly impressed with his approach to border management. He probably shouldn't have been rolling the boulder around, but that is what we are saying has happened.
Right, I'll have a little think about this. If the listeners haven't read their copy of the magazine yet, feel free to make your guess before the end of the show. We can find out the answer together. So now it's time for our three big stories from the week. Kieran, what big story have you been finding out about?
Well, I couldn't come on the podcast and not talk about what has become my favourite subject this year, which is, of course, Mars and the absolute hubbub that is happening there at the moment. Because, as we talked about on the podcast earlier in the year, three different spacecraft made their way there, setting off in the summer of last year and arriving in the sort of late winter, early spring of this year. The news this week, though, is that China has become the second country ever to land a spacecraft on Mars. Bex, points for telling me what the other country is?
I don't know, Kieran.
our listeners are screaming at their devices this very second. It's the US. Yes, well done, Bex.
Oh, sure, that was... Yeah, I was giving the listeners a chance to seem clever, to feel clever. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
Sure, thank you. shows how much you're all listening to this podcast. Okay, so on the 15th of May, the China National Space Administration, or the CNSA for short, announced that its rover had successfully landed on the red planet. So Zhurong, which is the rover, is named after the god of fire from ancient Chinese mythology. And you might remember us talking about this mission to Mars before, because as I said, it was one of those three to arrive in early 2021. And since February, it has been orbiting the planet of Mars.
So tell me, why did it take so long to actually land?
Well, mostly because landing on Mars is a very tricky thing to do. Many spacecraft that get sent there, I think almost half over the years, have just crashed as part of that landing attempt. And so, unlike the US, which put its Perseverance rover down sort of straight away as soon as it arrived at Mars, the CNSA decided that they would spend a few months taking images of the surface to find the best and safest place to land. And that's what happened on the 15th of May. The rover started its descent to an area of Mars that's called Utopia Planitia. Great name. And it's thought that that area would once have been an ocean that has long since dried up. And it's the perfect place to land because it's nice and flat, but also The rover is specifically looking for signs of past life, which would include evidence of water on Mars, like a dried up ocean. So it took 9 months for 9 minutes, sorry, for it to go from orbit to the surface. And it's got 90 Martian days now, a Martian day being a little over 24 hours to carry out its work. And as I said, it's going to be looking for those signs of life. It's got cameras to do that. It's got a laser which can zap open rocks in order to see what they're made of, and a radar as well, which will be able to scan deep beneath the surface to find evidence of water and ice, with the hope being that if it can, that this could be the start of evidence that at some point in history, life did flourish on Mars.
Now let's check in with Flora. Flora, what have you been finding out about?
I've been finding out all about the Million Mile Beach Clean, which is incredibly cool. It's one of the biggest projects to tackle plastic pollution, and it began on the 15th of May in the UK. It was started by an organisation called Surfers Against Sewage, and their aim is to galvanise 100,000 volunteers to clean up 10 miles of coast or countryside each over this year. And it started with a launch week on 15th of May, in which 50,000 volunteers, armed with litter pickers and buckets, cleaned up around 350,000 miles worth of land. And for this piece, I spoke to Hugo Tagholm, who's the CEO of Surfers Against Sewage, lives in Cornwall, for this piece. And he was very insistent that you don't need to live near a beach to get involved. It's just as valid to clean up canals, waterways, parks and pavements. So you can even get involved if you live in London or any city. I also spoke to an 11-year-old litter picker called George, who was cleaning up his local river in Bristol. And he was saying how much he loved the feeling of getting outside, cleaning up the river, and also how he enjoyed the competitive element of beating his sister to fill the most bags.
Very important. So tell me, why is cleaning up the plastic just so important to us?
Well, it's a really big issue for the environment today. Many scientists believe that there's a crisis of plastic pollution in the ocean, which is really terrible for sea creatures. They can suffocate on the plastic, and there's various other kinds of problems it creates. Surfers Against Sewage have actually carried out surveys all about plastic, and they have shown that littering on beaches and in nature in general has gone up in lockdown. And I don't know about you guys, but I do see so much plastic waste at the moment everywhere I go. And there's also a double benefit to this cleanup, which Hugo Tagholm talked about. He was discussing how people like getting outside, and it's really good for us. And actually cleaning up your area is also really good for your mental health. And, you know, it means you can get out and about, walk around with friends and help the environment as you do so. So what's not to like?
Absolutely. Tell me, how can we get involved?
So you can go to the Surfers Against Sewage website, and there's a link to that in the magazine on that story, which is on our UK news pages. And you can find your local register clean, and you can also create your own mini clean with fewer than 10 people. And there are instructions how to do that, or how to start up your own beach clean in your own community.
Next up, we go to Hugh. Hugh, welcome to the show. Tell me, what story do you have for us today?
Well, football story. We had two cup finals last week. One was the Women's Champions League final, and the other was the Men's FA Cup final. Firstly, though, I'd like to apologise to all Chelsea supporters. Yes, Chelsea were in two cup finals last week. Unfortunately, they lost both of them. The Women's European Champions League final was in Gothenburg in Sweden on Sunday, the 16th of May. Barcelona Femenina beat Chelsea 4-0. Chelsea made it pretty hard for themselves right from the start. They went 1-0 down in less than a minute. In fact, it was 33 seconds that they went 1-0 down, and all four goals were scored in the first half. But that makes Barcelona the first Spanish team to win the European Champions League. Nobody from England has won it yet since Arsenal. Despite the horrible own goal, though, it was an attempted clearance by Fran Kirby. The Chelsea strikers has a really amazing season. She's played 18 games in the Women's Super League this season in England, and she scored 16 times, which even for non-football fans, she'll work out is quite a high return rate. She's also got 11 assists. Now, an assist is just counted when a person makes a final pass or a cross to the goal scorer. Doesn't count towards the score, but what it means for Stato people like me is that it means she's pretty good at setting up goals as well as scoring her own. And she's formed a really great partnership up front with Sam Kerr, who's an Australian that Chelsea bought from Chicago Red Stars in the US Soccer League last season. So reaching the European final was actually a big deal for Chelsea, though, because they've never played in the final before. This season, Emma Hayes' Chelsea side have already won the English Women's Super League and have won the League Cup, and they're still in the mix for the FA Cup as well. So though the final for that won't be played until December.
So tell me, how did Chelsea's men's team get on in their FA Cup final?
As you already know, because I've spoiled the lead, they got beat. They got beat by Leicester City 1-0. Their Belgian striker, Youri Tielemans, scored an incredible goal from 35 yards. But, I mean, it was all about Leicester City. They're everybody's favourite underdogs. If you follow football at all, or even if you don't, you'll notice that they won the Premier League in 2016, which was just incredible. They were 5,000-1 outsiders when they did it. So it was the kind of fairy tale that doesn't often happen in football, I think. And this was their first FA Cup. They'd been in the final 4 times. The last time was in 1969. So for them, it was just incredible. And I guess they were the underdog, and it made it all the more exciting. The game itself, the fans were back to an extent. It made it a bit more dramatic. There were 21,000 in Wembley, which holds almost 90,000, I think, socially distanced, that kind of thing. But it made a massive difference just having some atmosphere in the stadium for once, even for those watching on TV. And there was drama on the pitch at the end as well, because Chelsea actually thought they'd equalised in the very last minute to push the game to extra time. But VAR ruled that Ben Chilwell was offside. VAR is the video assistant referee, which people love or hate, mostly hate. If you're a Chelsea fan, you'll definitely hate them. But it was not to be. So, you know, Leicester held on for the 1-0 win, won the cup for the first time. Detail, Chelsea found some redemption this week. On Tuesday night, they actually beat Leicester City in the Premier League. And that puts them in a much better position for qualifying for the European Champions League next season, probably at the expense of Leicester City. So there you go.
So loads of other stuff has been going on this week. Also, the British Book Awards took place, and writer Michael, who you might know because he's a regular on this podcast, he interviewed 2 winning authors, and they answered a couple of questions for the Week Junior Show. So here they are.
Hi there, listeners of the Week Junior Show. We are MG Leonard and
Sam Sedgman, authors of The Highland Falcon Thief, winner of the British Book Award for Children's Fiction, supported by The Week Junior. And we're here to answer 2 very important questions.
Firstly, do we like Marmite?
I love Marmite. I will have Marmite on anything. Marmite on toast, Marmite on pasta. I adore Marmite, and I think one of the reasons I like Marmite is I used to be allergic to it when I was younger. It made me have a big rash around my mouth, but I loved it, but I would eat it anyway. But thankfully, as a grown-up, that no longer happens, and I can have Marmite whenever I like.
I too love Marmite, and my favourite Marmite sandwich is when you take a packet of salt and vinegar crisps, and you put Marmite on the bread, and then you put crisps in the sandwich, and you smush the second slice of bread on the top, and then you eat the crunchy Marmite salty vinegary goodness.
A second question is, what were our favourite books growing up?
Well, my favourite book growing up was The Twits by Roald Dahl. I really love that story. I've read it more than any other because it makes me howl with laughter. I love the nasty tricks that they play on each other. I love the idea of feeding someone worm spaghetti. So that was my favourite funny book. And then the other book that made a really big impact on me was The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. And that book taught me, because I didn't have gardens when I was a kid, that you don't need to have lots of knowledge to enjoy nature. You can learn at any time.
I also loved reading Roald Dahl when I was growing up. My favourite book was Matilda. I loved that being really clever and reading books could give you special powers. And it can't make you move objects with your mind, but it does give you special powers to read books, it turns out. Reading books is a fantastic thing to do. and we should all be doing more of it. I also really love to read books by Terry Pratchett, who I found really funny and also really lovely, and he created wonderful, joyful fantasy worlds that I wanted to spend all of my time with. And when I was a little older, I would read grown-up books by Agatha Christie because people got murdered in them, and I quite liked that.
Some excellent book choices there. Congratulations to MG Leonard and Sam Sedgman on their award. You can read the rest of Michael's fantastic interview in the current issue of The Week Junior, and we'll hear from another brilliant author later in the show as well. Because now it's time for the big debate. And this week we're asking if ancient monuments should be altered. Who can tell me a little bit more?
It's me this week. I believe this is the idea that historical attractions are recreating structures or parts of structures anyway, in order to enhance the experience for visitors. And that is pegged to the news story that the Colosseum in Rome, the government in Italy, have announced that they have created a special floor. The Colosseum is a huge open-air theatre known as an amphitheatre, which was built almost 2,000 years ago at the time of the Roman Empire. The original floor of the Colosseum was made of wood, so that's gone over the years. Today, visitors can see right through and underneath the floor, including the corridors where the gladiators waited to fight. Now, this new floor that they're looking to construct covers this view and instead allows the visitors to stand where the gladiators once fought.
Okay then, so this is going to be Flora versus Kieran. And guys, I don't want to remind you every week, but I will just in case. You've got a minute each to make your point. Is that okay?
Yes, it is.
Yep.
Okay, good. So Flora is up first. She is arguing to say it's okay to alter these monuments. So Flora, whenever you're ready, go for it.
Well, we all know that sore leg, brain dead sort of feeling when you've been walking around a museum for ages and seeing loads of ancient objects behind glass screens with teeny little inscriptions about how long ago they were used, and frankly, no one cares. It's not exciting to be told about something ancient, but what is exciting is when those ancient objects or ancient monuments come to life. And this, for this to happen, they have to be adapted over the years to become relevant to the modern day, and also to allow visitors to live and breathe in those places where our ancient ancestors did. And the Colosseum is a really good example of this, I think. At the moment, we look over the railings into the broken stones of the corridors where the gladiators waited to fight. We can even take a tour through the Hypogeum, as it is known, technically. But we can't actually follow the gladiators up onto the stage because it doesn't exist anymore. Now we can, though, with the excellent addition of a fully retractable floor, which allows us the gladiator's eye view. Okay, it's not an ancient floor, but it is in the spirit of the ancient monument, which is much more interesting to see and to feel than some old crumbling stones.
Well, Flora, you know that was a very good argument, but you also know what I'm going to say, don't you?
Did I go over?
Yes.
Oh, no. See, what I never time myself because I feel I've got a really distinctive understanding of a minute. I think I've got an internal clock, but obviously I don't.
Well,
How much over?
6 or 7 seconds.
Oh, no.
Let's just say that your internal clock is ever so slightly out of kilter with Google's timer. Let's put it like that.
And 6 seconds is a lot in a minute.
Well, yeah. That's why I brought it up, to be honest. But it's okay, you made a good argument, that's all right. And now it's up to Kieran to argue back. So, Kieran, whenever you're ready, go for it.
Do I get 66 seconds as well?
Yes, Kieran, you do.
Yes, all right, to make it fair, I'll give you an extra.
So wrapped with guilt.
Didn't realise I was going to open up this can of time worms. Yes, you get an extra 6 seconds. Whenever you're ready, take it away.
As Hugh says, the Colosseum has been around for almost 2,000 years, and it's hard to see the argument that now is suddenly the time to give it a makeover. You don't go to somewhere like that with the expectation of it being in perfect nick or looking exactly like it did in ye olde days. Part of the fascination is seeing it as history has left it. Now, without getting too deep, because I've only got 66 seconds, there's a famous argument called the Ship of Theseus. And Theseus was an explorer in Greek mythology. And there is a debate that if you took his ship that he used to explore and over time replaced every plank of wood to do repair work, you'd end up with a new ship that had none of its original parts. Is that still the Ship of Theseus, or is it a brand new ship? Now, I think this is a brand new ship. If you can't start introducing new floors, if you start introducing new walls, making all these alterations to a historic monument, it's not the same monument that it was to begin with. We should care for these historical sites, yes, and preserve them as best we can, but change them, that's a no from me.
Oh, well done. Okay, lovely. You didn't even need those 6 seconds. Hugh, tell me, who do you agree with?
Well, that was actually a very persuasive argument from Kieran, which I didn't really expect, because I thought I was pro Flora before I had any notion. But having said that, I think Flora is right. I think that it is, particularly in this case, this retractable floor, you're not knocking down the Colosseum and building a new one. You're giving access and allowing people to see, and you're giving access to people that wouldn't normally have access to things, I don't think so. And there might be more nice coffee shops with cake, so I'm saying Flora.
Oh my goodness, I was on the fence until you mentioned coffee shops, and now you've persuaded me for Flora. So this is the big debate, but of course it's the listeners who really are in control here. So let us know what you think right now. Go respond to the poll at theweekjunior.co.uk/polls or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk with a video clip explaining what side of the debate you support and why. Last week on the podcast, we debated whether football clubs should be owned by their fans. This was relatively close. 58% of you thought that clubs should not be owned by fans, with just 42% of you saying clubs were better off being run by supporters. So here are some of your comments.
This one really split opinion on PopJam. So one person commented, yes, football fans should be able to show their love for football just as much as the players do. Another PopJam user disagreed, saying no, because they might make silly choices that cause the team issues.
Another PopJammer told us, no, because sometimes football fans don't agree on the same suggestions, and that could lead to big arguments. However, Mila, age 10, emailed us saying, I think that fans should be able to own their teams because fans are drawn by their shared love of football. The people that work for the team, however, only do it for the money because it's their job.
So remember, as you heard, this is your chance to get involved. Grab a grown-up and record a video telling us what you think of this week's debate, then send it in to us at hello@theweekjunior.co.uk, and we could play it out on next week's show. Now, before Kieran reveals the answer to this week's real or rubbish question, we're going to hear from another author.
Hi there, listeners of The Week Junior Show. My name is Sam Thompson, author of Wolf's Tongue, which has been selected as Book of the Week in the current issue of the magazine, and I'm here to answer two very important questions. Firstly, do I like Marmite? Yes, a lot. Everyone else in my house hates it, but I don't care. Secondly, what was my favourite book growing up? It was Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak, because it's very important sometimes to wear your wolf suit and make mischief of one kind and another.
Another fan of Marmite! Well, we probably shouldn't be surprised at this point, I suppose. And it's clear that Kieran loves the idea of putting on a wolf suit and making mischief, because that's exactly what he's done with Real or Rubbish this week. Kieran, can you remind us of the story?
Not sure how I feel about that introduction. Yes, this week's story is that a farmer in Belgium accidentally shrank France and made Belgium bigger by moving a stone that was setting out the border between the two countries.
Now, this is quite a legacy. If you were the person to change the border or the barrier of a country, normally you have to be a king in battle or you have to be a politician. So to be a humble farmer, I quite like the idea of that, but it does seem quite far-fetched, doesn't it? To be in charge of changing the size and shape of a country.
Yes.
Oh, come on. Yeah, thanks, Kieran. Cheers.
Yes.
He says after a 5 second delay.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's, you know, like I mentioned my example of, you know, Scotland and England, Wales and England, those borders are there and I wouldn't really know exactly where they were unless they had a big fence or a gate or a Hadrian's Wall. So I'm going to say the possibility of it, I think it's one of those things that's ridiculous, but I think it's true. I'm going to say this story is real.
So you're saying that the border between two countries is literally marked by a boulder?
Don't do this to me. Don't repeat what I've just said and make it sound ridiculous.
No, do not touch. Do not move this boulder.
It's a load-bearing boulder. That is what I'm saying. I am saying this story is real. I think the farmer didn't know the border gold he was sitting on, and I think it's a true story.
Okay, well, could I have a drum roll, please? It's real.
Yes!
You're right, Bex. Yes, you are right. The border is marked by a boulder, bizarrely. Although, since the news of this came to light, the Belgian authorities have been in touch for a word and have told the farmer to put the stone back to where it should be.
I like to think they've just stuck it down with some super glue just to make sure it's safe.
Hopefully this time they'll put something on it to say, please, do not move this boulder.
A little sign. This is France, this is Belgium. Well, thank you for that, Kieran. Thanks for giving me absolutely no help whatsoever. And that is it for the Week Junior show this week. Drop us a comment on PopJam at The Week Junior or email hello@theweekjunior.co.uk. And don't forget to rate, review and subscribe or follow us wherever it is you get your podcasts. Bye!
If you want to get your hands on a copy of The Week Junior magazine, we're offering a 6-week free trial. To get yours, head over to dennismags.co.uk/theweekjunior and use the code PODCAST.